Well, I want to talk today about the revival of the Holy Roman Empire. One of the most famous encounters between the Holy Roman emperors and the papacy was during the reign of Henry IV, who was emperor of the Holy Roman Empire about 1,000 years ago, from 1056 to 1106. I'll read you a couple of paragraphs from the book A Short History of the World by J.M. Roberts, published in 1993, pages 232 and 233. Many churchmen for many years had been sure the church was in need of reform. They attacked simony, the buying of preferment, the marriage of priests, and interference with them. Perhaps, too, it says the emperors were bound to find themselves in conflict with the papacy sooner or later. The Pope issued a decree on lay investiture. It's known to have forbidden any layman to invest a cleric with a bishopric or other ecclesiastical office. In other words, the decree from the Pope was that the kings could not give a position in the church to anybody. And what had been happening was that people, you know, would hand over bribes, basically, to get a big position, like a bishop or an archbishop, so that then they could take some of the collection every Sunday. To cap matters, Pope Gregory summoned the emperor to Rome to appear before him. Henry IV responded by getting a German synod to declare Gregory deposed, so this conflict between church and state. This earned him excommunication, the greatest weapon the Pope had. You excommunicate a king, and then, of course, he's in danger of losing his throne, because the people will turn against him, and also because the people may be denied some of the religious rights. So Gregory excommunicated Henry IV. In the end, Henry had to give way. He came in humiliation to Canossa, where he waited in the snow barefoot until Gregory would receive his penance in one of the most dramatic of all confrontations of lay and spiritual authority. So Henry ended up having to go to the Pope and beg for mercy. And he went to the Pope's palace at Canossa, and he was left standing barefoot in the snow for 3 days. And this was, of course, a deliberate attempt by the Pope to humiliate the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. The relationship between church and state has not always been an easy one, which is exactly what the Bible predicted. If you look at Revelation chapter 17, which is one of the chapters that deals with this subject, in Revelation chapter 17, it describes the relationship between the church and the state as one of fornication. In verse 1, it says, "One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, 'Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot,'" this false religious system. The true church is pictured by a woman dressed in white, a bride, pure, beautiful. But the false church is depicted by a great harlot who sits on many waters, having universal power, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. You know, fornication is never an easy relationship. In a relationship based on fornication, each person is trying to get from the other. In marriage, a husband and wife are giving to each other. So there's a difference in the emphasis and a difference in the relationship. And invariably, when people fornicate, the relationship ends up as being rather tumultuous and usually ends up breaking up, and one person is hurt and one person's angry, those kind of things. Well, it's exactly the same in the relationship between the church and the state in the history of Europe. So here then is this false church with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. When people are drunk, they don't know what they're doing. Here they are drunk on false religion. They believe that what they believe is the truth, that the church is the true church that was founded by Jesus Christ, when in actual fact it is not the true church, and its doctrines partly come from paganism. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, royal colors, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. A fabulously wealthy institution is what is predicted here, what was prophesied to happen. And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, because that's where many of the religious teachings of this religious institution go back to ancient Babylon, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. We heard what Mr. Weber was speaking about, how the church was persecuted and fled into the wilderness. And, you know, this was the church that was doing the persecuting, the false religious organization. But John says, when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. You do have to marvel, because this institution has lasted longer than any other institution in Europe. Almost 2,000 years. And although sometimes it does not do too well, there's been times where it rises, times where it falls, times where it is just out of favor, so to speak, and is not very powerful, it always bounces back. And Bible prophecy shows that we're going to see another revival of the Roman system, including a role for the church. Daniel chapter 7, prophesied a little horn. In Daniel 7, we'll look at this a little bit more later on, because I want to give you a PowerPoint showing a few maps and showing you this institution throughout the centuries. But notice in verse 8, there is a description of a little horn coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. A horn is symbolic of royal authority. But this is not the normal or usual royal authority. It is not a king with a vast army. It is rather an institution with eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking pompous words. There's an elaboration further down when we get to verses 23 through 27. It says, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms. In verse 24, the ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from the kingdom, and another shall rise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High. We're back to this religious institution again. Pompous words, thinking himself really great, greater than God, vicar of Christ. Vicar means in place of. So in the mind of the person holding this office, he sits as Jesus Christ, as God, presiding over the affairs of the earth. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law, the Sabbath to Sunday, the holy days to Christmas and Easter, and other things. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. So again, that prophecy about the persecution of the true church. The papacy has been the most powerful institution of the last 2,000 years. What we need to understand, because right now we're living in a period of time where its power has been contained. And we need to understand why. The power of the papacy was contained by the Protestant Reformation and the rise of the English-speaking nations to preeminence. It was in England that the Protestant Reformation was secured, partly because England was an island, or Britain, rather, is an island. And because of that, Britain was somewhat separated from the continent of Europe. And once Elizabeth I secured the Protestant Reformation in Britain, Protestantism was secured. It was secured with the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588, which was the end of that 1260-year period that we heard about earlier, of the persecution of God's people. And, the Spanish Armada was sent under the authority of the Pope to force England back into the Catholic fold. But because England was cut off somewhat from Catholic Europe, England had to start and look for trade elsewhere, as a result of which you had the development of colonies, which, of course, eventually led to the formation of the United States of America and other countries around the world as well. So the church then was somewhat tamed, but the church is still a very powerful institution. And the church was the successor of the Roman Empire. Let me read to you from a book called The Offshore Islanders by Paul Johnson, written in 1972. Paul Johnson is a British historian. After writing this book, he converted to Catholicism. He says, though the administrative center of the empire had been transferred to Byzantium, the state religion was still centrally conducted from Rome. Already, indeed, its chain of command and its contacts with outlying regions such as Britain were maintained in a more regular fashion than the political and military functions of the empire. Christianity still had a working international infrastructure. This religion, by its very nature, was centralized, universalist, authoritarian, and anti-regional. It was run by a disciplined priestly caste, commanded by bishops based on the imperial urban centers, under the ultimate authority of the Bishop of Rome itself, the spiritual voice of the Western Empire. Its doctrines were absolutist, preaching unthinking submission to divine authority, the emperor and his high priest, the Bishop of Rome, in this world, and a unitary God who appointed the emperor in the next. This is the way the church controlled the people. Now, again, let's just think this through a little bit and understand it in the context of time. You know, we only live 70 years and seven on average. So to us, this is the way the world's been. You know, unless you're over 60, you cannot possibly remember a time when the United States was not the dominant nation in the world. And nobody can remember a time when one of the English-speaking powers was not the dominant nation. The United States as a country has only existed for 230 years. You know, here we're talking about an institution that has lasted 2,000 years. We're also talking about a period of time where the church was so powerful and its control over the people so great that it lasted for 1,260 years. You know, a lot longer than the United States has existed. The period of time that we are living in now with religious freedom really is an aberration in history. It is not typical of history at all. Religious freedom is something fairly new. Again, I quote from Paul Johnson's book, "The Roman Church spoke for the empire. When the empire fell apart in the West in 476, the church simply took over." You see this illustrated beautifully if you go to the city of York in the north of England, which is near where I come from. When I was a child and went there from school, they had not yet excavated the foundations. When I went back in 1994, they had finished excavating the foundations. And you can actually go down now into the foundations, and you see a great deal of the way that Rome was in ancient times. Because it turns out the church, the Minster, York Minster, the cathedral, was built on top of the Roman military headquarters. You see, as the empire collapsed, the church simply took over. The former military administrative units of the empire became the bishoprics of the church. So the bishop ruled over exactly the same area that a military commander had ruled over before him. When you go down into the foundations, you can stand on the very spot where the Emperor Constantine was crowned or proclaimed emperor in 306 AD. In fact, there's a bust of the Emperor Constantine outside of the cathedral when you exit by the side door. And, Constantine was the one who later converted to Christianity or Catholicism and became one of the most significant of all the emperors of Rome. I want to quote to you from what is, I think, the definitive book on the history of the papacy during this particular time period, The Decline and Fall of the Medieval Papacy, by Elliot Binns, written in 1934. He points out that decisive in this transition from the Roman Empire to the Roman Church was the retention of the title Pontifex Maximus, which made the emperor head of the old pagan religion, as he was in practice of the new Christian church. So his title remained the same. You know, he was the supreme pontiff from the ancient Roman pagan religion transferred to the new religion. And when the empire collapsed, the papacy simply carried on. When there was no longer an emperor in the West and the link with the East was but slender, papal Rome took the place of imperial Rome. During the last century of the Western Empire, the position of the popes was becoming ever stronger. At first, the government of the church had been modeled on that of the empire, and in the early Middle Ages, it continued to develop on the lines of a secular power. A writer of the 9th century draws out the parallels between the emperor who governed the world and the pope who governed the church. As the former has under him kings and counts and lesser nobles, so the latter has archbishops and bishops and inferior clergy, a strict hierarchical structure. Back to Paul Johnson, the Roman Church strongly and repeatedly condemned round tables. You've all heard of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, very much a part of ancient legends in England. Have you ever thought about what the round table meant to the development of the English-speaking peoples? There is a concept of equality in a round table. The Catholic Church has always been against round tables because, you know, there's a very strict hierarchical structure. According to Paul Johnson, the world was Christ's kingdom, the Pope his vicar, exercising all authority whatsoever, with the Church as his spiritual and the state his secular arm. Bishops and kings alike would be mere functionaries of Rome, with the priest emperor transmitting to them the commands of the deity. Not until the Communist Manifesto of 1848 did the governments of the world face such an audacious program of international subversion. It was a threat to the established order of all countries. But it was in England that it was most bitterly resented and most fiercely resisted. Here, for the first time, England was to lead the struggle against a deliberate attempt to set up a European tyranny. And this is Paul Johnson's book, The Offshore Islanders. Go back to Revelation 17. Revelation 17. We've already looked at the first six verses, which talk of this false religious system. And in verse 9, it says, "Here is the mind which has wisdom, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. And the beast that was and is not is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings, who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings." So what we see here is this system continues right through until the second coming of Jesus Christ. It also tells us that there are seven mountains on which the woman sits. This false religious system sits on these seven mountains. A mountain is a great empire. A hill is a minor country. So we're looking here at different resurrections of the Roman Empire that have continued throughout history. But remember, the Roman Church continued the empire. Even today, Latin is still the language of the church. It still has an emperor, the Pope. I heard on the radio yesterday when I was driving down here, there's a kind of a fake election going on in the country of Belarus. I think it's tomorrow. And it described Belarus on the news as the last dictatorship in Europe. And I thought, that's not true. because the Vatican is the last, is another dictatorship. Because again, you have this absolute authority, an absolute monarch, in the same way as it was in the Middle Ages in all countries. But it has continued in one country, the Vatican City. And remember, the church is a country. Just to digress for a moment there, when my wife and I and our children lived in Ghana, we used to walk regularly in our neighborhood. And in the neighborhood, we had the residence of the papal nuncio, the papal ambassador to Ghana. And he was the doyen of the diplomatic corps, meaning he was the senior diplomat. He had been in Ghana longer than any other diplomat. When the U.S. or Britain send an ambassador to a country like Ghana, he stays for 2 years, maybe three at the outside, because it's not considered a very pleasant posting. But when the Vatican sends somebody, he stays for life. He doesn't have a wife and children to think about. So very quickly in all countries, the Vatican's ambassador rises to a position of great influence. So when any new ambassadors from any country arrive in Ghana, he is the one who welcomes them, tells them about Ghana, introduces them to all the different peoples in government and so on. So this is a very powerful political institution. It is a country with its own flag, with its own territory. You know, the Italian state does not have the authority to go into that territory, even though it is within the city of Rome. But it is a nation, and we fail to remember that sometimes. I want to show you here, if you go back to Daniel chapter 7, I want to show you just what has happened throughout history and how things have been constantly changing. In Daniel chapter 7, we see an account of the Roman Empire, but we also see the empires that were before it. So let me show you here. Daniel 2, verse 21 is a good place to begin. God removes kings and raises up kings. Let us remember that. There is a plan that is being worked out. We know there is to be this final resurrection of the Roman Empire. We've already seen that in Revelation chapter 17. The United States will not be the world's number one power right up until the very end, until the return of Jesus Christ. So we can see that from prophecy. Now look at Daniel chapter 7. Four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. We don't have time to go into all the details here, but we'll look at the overview here. Daniel 7, verses 17 to 18. Those great beasts which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. So, you know, this false religious system, these beasts, go right down to the second coming of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the kingdom of God. And yet we are right now in a world where there is no beast. There is no beast power, no prophesied beast power. Right now the United States dominates. Before the U.S. it was the British Empire. But we see again that this period that we're living through really is just a brief blip in history. It's an aberration, really, because the nature of most empires in the world has been aggressive and despotic. Daniel 7, verse 4, the first beast then was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Remember in Revelation 17 and verse 5, it described the false religious system as Babylon the Great. That's because it does have its origin in Babylon. Babylon was the first empire mentioned here, and it was the empire in which Daniel was a captive, a slave, and served two of its kings. So here is the Babylonian Empire. The captivity of the Jews lasted 70 years. Here's the Babylonian Empire, where history really started and where history is continuing today, because, you know, Iraq is right in the middle of all of this. Nothing's improved in 2,600 years. And we expect to solve the problems in, you know, 2,600 days. Daniel 7, verse 5. Suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they said, thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. This is the Persian Empire, which came after the Babylonian Empire. The Persian Empire had slightly different borders. Persian Empire went further east, for example, but it included much of the Babylonian Empire. In fact, it defeated the Babylonian Empire. Daniel 7, verse 6, after this I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. That is the Greek Empire, which then was divided into four upon the death of Alexander the Great. Here's the Greek Empire's four divisions, divided amongst the four generals. The two which are important are Ptolemy in the south, the purpley colored area, which is Egypt, which, as you can see, ruled the Holy Land. But also to the east is the Seleucid Empire, founded by Seleucus, one of the generals of Alexander the Great. And those two fought a great deal. They are the kings of the north and king of the south that are prophesied in Daniel chapter 11. Now here, let's move on here. Daniel 7, verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. This is the Roman Empire, the next empire. The Roman Empire was the biggest of all those empires. You know, in the east, it had control of the Glorious Land or the Holy Land. Right in the northwest, it took England. In fact, it conquered just about everything and got to the border of Scotland, saw those men in skirts and decided that was enough. So they built a great big wall to keep them out. One of the best investments ever made in Britain. Daniel 7, verse 8. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom three of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth. Uh-oh, I was trying to get the last sentence on. Never mind. A mouth speaking pompous words. Then I wished to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and about the other horn which came up, before whom three fell, namely, that horn which had eyes and a mouth that spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. You know, the papacy was extremely powerful and was considered to be over the kings. I'll read you a quote about Charlemagne in a moment, which will help illustrate that. Remember, all these horns are royal power, royal authority. I don't think it has to be royal. I think when it talks about the 10 kings at the end, for example, it could be 10 presidents or prime ministers. I don't think it has to be kings as such. But normally in history, it has been kings. Daniel 7, verses 21 and 22, I was watching. The same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High. And the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Verses 24 and 25. This is slow. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the first ones and shall subdue three kings. He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand for a time, and times, and half a time. That period of time again, during which the church, the true followers of God, were persecuted. You know, when the false church was in charge during the period of the Inquisition, the first question that people were asked when they were brought before the ecclesiastical court, the Inquisition, was, have you ever read all or part of the Bible in your own language? And if the answer was yes, then you were put to death. William Tyndale was burned at the stake in October of 1536 for publishing and distributing Bibles. You know, we forget all this. And, you know, we really do not appreciate the Bible as much as we should, because a lot of people died in order to bring it to us. The little horn then, described here, is the papacy. And The first three horns plucked up by the roots. These are three horns that did not put down any roots in Italy. They were not great civilizations. They were really barbaric tribes who took over Rome, and they tried to rule Rome, the Vandals, and then Odoacer and the Ostrogoths. These were the first three horns plucked up by the roots. The church did not have authority over these. This is why they are mentioned very briefly here. They were plucked up by the roots. It was after they had gone that the church then played a major role in European history. Now, the church was already there in the last century of the Roman Empire, before its collapse in 476 AD. The church was very much involved in things. But when these barbaric tribes came in, the church did not was not involved, because they were not Catholic. But now the church was going to play a major role in European history and the revivals of the Roman Empire throughout history. Okay, here we come now to the other resurrections then. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. So these are the resurrections of the Roman Empire where the church was involved. In the middle of the 6th century, the Emperor Justinian, who was the emperor in the east in Byzantium, tried to resurrect the Western Empire. All of those areas colored purple on the left were areas that he conquered, and they then became the Western Empire in a revived form. But it didn't last. It didn't last very long once Justinian was gone. The second attempt, Charlemagne's, was more important. This is a revival of the Western Empire. Charlemagne was crowned by the Pope on Christmas Day in the year 800. And Charlemagne is the inspiration for the unification of Europe today. In fact, Charlemagne ruled from the town of Aachen, or Aachen, which you can see in the north there. And Aachen is his former capital. He's buried there. And every year, the people of the town give the Charlemagne Prize to whichever person in the world has done the most to bring about the unification of Europe. Three American presidents have received that prize, including our former president, Bill Clinton. The person who received the prize just over a year ago was Pope John Paul II, which again just shows that continuity, you see, in history of the church and the state, and the church being very involved in politics. The church is very supportive of the idea of the unification of Europe. I want to quote to you from a book called The Principality and Power of Europe by Adrian Hilton, published in 1997. In AD 800, Charlemagne, or Charles the Great, a zealous Roman Catholic, was crowned Imperator Romanorum, Emperor of the Romans, by Pope Leo III. He became Western Europe's Christian Caesar, a Roman emperor born of a Germanic race. The West once again had an emperor, and his coronation was to become the central event of the Middle Ages. He was proclaimed King Father of Europe and espoused the ideal of a unified Christian empire, Christianized at sword point, that is, in close alliance with the Pope. The fact that Charlemagne received his crown from the Pope was seen by the populace as equal to a divine bestowal. The Pope is the vicar of Christ. What he does comes from God. When he makes a pronouncement, it is ex cathedra. It is from God. That is, you know, the belief that millions of people have. It confirmed the perception that the imperial crown was a papal gift, and that the kingdoms of this earth belonged to the Bishop of Rome. They were his to give and his to take away. And that's the way it was in Europe right up until the Protestant Reformation. Again, I quote to you from this book by Adrian Hilton. The two had become joint sovereigns on earth in a Holy Roman Empire, which was the political foundation of the Middle Ages. The Holy Roman Empire lasted just over 1,000 years. So about five times as long as the United States has lasted as a country. Throughout this era, the memory of the once great Roman Empire lived as a vital tradition in the hearts of many Europeans. The entire future of the continent was bound up in this coronation. and the alliance between the papacy and Germany has been of great significance ever since. So that was Charlemagne's empire. After his reign, his sons and grandsons kind of messed things up, and so the empire was revived in the middle of the 10th century by Otto the Great. And this was the Holy Roman Empire from that date forward. And its borders varied, you know, considerably over the years. Here again is the Holy Roman Empire at a very significant time during the period of Charles V in the middle of the 1500s. The Habsburgs, who were a major family in Europe, they ruled Central Europe for over 600 years until 1918. And in fact, even before they took over the throne of Austria, they were the Dukes of Burgundy. So they go back over 1,000 years, just this one family. And Charles V also ruled part of the United States, the Southwest, that the Pope gave to the Spanish, belonged to Charles V because he was also the King of Spain. His son Philip II became one of the most important monarchs of Spain, and he was the one given the authority by the Pope to force England back into the Catholic Church, which would have stopped the Protestant Reformation, and the United States would never have existed if he had succeeded. So the Spanish Armada and its defeat in 1588 was very significant in American history. So this is the empire of Charles V. Now, the Holy Roman Emperor, or empire, is considered the First Reich. And it lasted for 1,000 years. Now, here's another resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire under Napoleon. Napoleon also had an attempt at, world conquest. And he was defeated finally by England, and one or two other countries helped. Prussia helped in 1815. But Napoleon, again, was in another attempt at world domination. Revelation 17, verse 10. 5 have fallen, 1 is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. So here's the next resurrection. This is the Second Reich. The First Reich was the Holy Roman Empire. A Reich is an empire. And that lasted for 1,000 years, from 800 to 1806. The Second Reich was the German Empire of the Kaisers. You know, the word Kaiser is exactly the same as Caesar. If you listen to the word in Aramaic, which was the language spoken in Christ's time, the pronunciation of Caesar was Kaiser. So the German Kaisers considered themselves successors of the Caesars. So did the Tsars of Russia. The word Tsar comes from Caesar as well, you see. So these empires, which lasted until the 20th century, considered themselves as successors of the Roman Empire. And the German Kaiser, of course, tried to dominate the world in World War I. This was the Second Reich. And then you had the Third Reich, which was Hitler's attempt to resurrect the Reich. And Hitler said that his Reich would last 1,000 years. He was slightly off. It only lasted 12. But, he proclaimed his Reich would last 1,000 years because, again, there was this desire to resurrect the Holy Roman Empire. And the church was involved in bringing this to fruition as well. There's a very good book on that called Hitler's Pope by John Cornwell about Pope Pius XII and how he contributed to the rise of Nazi Germany and turned a blind eye to the Holocaust when he was the only man in Europe that could have said anything to stop the Holocaust from taking place. So the Second Reich and the Third Reichs, we consider one resurrection of the Roman Empire for a couple of reasons. Partly, historians today can look at the two wars as one is a continuation from the other. This was the German attempt at world domination, which was thwarted by the Anglo-Saxon powers, the British Empire and the United States. But also the expression one is, because the church, which was raised up in this era in the 1920s and 1930s, was right in the middle of this. And so we tie that in with that particular passage of scripture there. But again, go back to Revelation chapter 17, because we need to understand that there is one more resurrection to come. The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. Revelation 17, verse 12, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings. And here is Europe today. There are 25 nations in the European Union. The darker blue patches, the light blue, the picture's slightly off here, but the light blue at the bottom right-hand corner are nations that have applied to join the European Union. You have to qualify to join the European Union. You have to be democratic, for example, to be a member. Your economy has to be at a certain level. You cannot, as a nation, overspend by more than 3% a year, which actually would disqualify the United States, because ours is 7%, which is, you know, a record for any Western country. Revelation 17:14. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. But, you know, these 25 nations in Europe, out of them are going to come these 10 nations. Now, it may be that the EU will fall apart first. I don't know. But it may be that the EU will split, because there are some countries that want a full united Europe and some that don't want to have one centralized authority. But there was an interesting article in the New Republic recently by Neil Ferguson, who's one of my favorite historians. Neil is spelled N-I-A-L-L. He's a professor at Harvard, though he comes from Scotland originally. Neil Ferguson wrote this. You know, he wrote about the rejection by two countries in Europe of the new European constitution. He wrote about its rejection and said, without the new constitution, Europe will look less like the United States and more like the Holy Roman Empire. You know, we've tended to, I don't mean we as a church, I mean we as a country have tended to, you know, look at Europe and think, well, the Europeans talk about uniting all the time, and we're expecting something like the United States of America. In fact, one American writer, a Washington Post bureau chief, T.R. Reid, wrote The United States of Europe. This was a book that came out last year. That was an expression that was used by Winston Churchill in 1946. After World War II, Churchill said, we need a kind of United States of Europe. We need to unite Europe. But the Europeans would never, ever, ever call their country a United States of Europe, because the whole desire to bring Europe together is motivated largely by anti-Americanism. So why would they use the expression United States of Europe? And secondly, you know, when they chose their currency, they called it the euro, not the euro dollar. A lot of people over here still call it the euro dollar, but they would not use the word dollar because they want a currency that's completely separate from the dollar. So the currency is simply called the euro. So remember, this is a motivating, driving force amongst the French and the Germans, especially as anti-Americanism. That's not true with some of the other countries, but it's certainly true with the nations that are the driving forces behind this. But Neil Ferguson brings out that the new Europe is going to resemble more the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Empire was a kind of a motley assortment of different nations. The emperor ruled directly over some territories, but then there were other territories that had their own kings and were largely independent and would cooperate with the emperor when they felt like it, but if they didn't, then they wouldn't. And then after Charles V, the emperor even had the empire even had the division of Protestants and Catholics. So, you know, the Holy Roman Empire was a strange conglomeration of nations. And one historian wrote, it was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire, which is true. But, you know, that's beside the point. So he writes, Neil Ferguson wrote, there will be no single European foreign minister to call when the American Secretary of State wants to speak to Europe. There will be no single European president, no grand European army. Instead, there will be a bewildering agglomeration of overlapping institutions and jurisdictions. Like the Holy Roman Empire before it, the European Union will continue to have its courts, its representative institutions, and its bureaucracy. But rather than a single strong executive arm, it will have multiple overlapping tentacles. T.R. Reid writes in his book, The United States of Europe, that the new Europe has more people, more wealth, and more trade than the United States of Europe. In fact, Europe is the dominant trading power in the world. The new Europe cannot match American military strength and doesn't want to, for that matter. But it has more votes in every international organization than the United States, and it gives away far more money in development aid. The result is global economic and political clout that makes the European Union exactly what its leaders want it to be, a second superpower that can stand on an equal footing with the United States. It is a very good book, this, The United States of Europe, if you want to get yourselves a copy. It's very easy to read, and he goes into just how powerful Europe is and how much more powerful it is than the U.S. in some respects. One final thing I want to read to you. Here's an article from the Philadelphia Inquirer. The Philadelphia Inquirer was one of only two American newspapers to republish the cartoons that led to the deaths of so many people around the world last month. Now, this article is not about the cartoons as such, but it is about the aftermath of the cartoons. The title of the article is Pope's Goal, Nothing Less Than Saving Europe. The present Pope, who is German, his goal is nothing less than saving Europe. As we enter the first Lent of Benedict XVI's young papacy, much has been made of American obsessions. The Church's stance on homosexuality, birth control, the ordination of women, that amount to little more than parochial concerns. They are of concerns over here. They are not concerns elsewhere, is the point that is being made. In so doing, Americans may miss the historic significance of the current pontificate. Pope Benedict is fighting for the future of Europe. To understand Benedict, there is no better place to start than God's Choice, George Weigel's brilliant and important book about Benedict's election. As the writer predicts, Benedict is likely to be the last European pope for a long time. The demographic makeup of the Catholic Church has changed in the blink of an eye. In 1978, according to Weigel, Africa had 55 million Catholics. By 2003, the number had gone to 144 million. That's in the reign of the last pope, John Paul II. By 2025, there may be 230 million Roman Catholics in Africa alone. The Church is similarly flourishing in Latin America. Of the 115 electors at last year's conclave, the electors choose the pope, with only 58 were European. 40% of the electing cardinals were from less developed countries. These numbers were not lost on the church hierarchy. In other words, you know, next time the pope is not likely to be a European. The article continues further down. Benedict is confronting Europe's grim prospects. A task the continent's leaders have abdicated. Europe, the pope writes in his forthcoming book, Without Roots, is not a geographic entity, but rather a cultural and historical concept. The term Europe did not become popular currency until the modern era, as a means of self-identification in response to the Turkish threat. Historically speaking, the advance of Islam in the 7th and early 8th centuries divided what had been a single continent into three, Africa, Asia, and Europe. Now, here's the final paragraph I want you to notice. The advance of Islam is once again a threat to the European concept. Addressing the Vatican's diplomatic corps, remember, the Vatican has ambassadors all over the world. In fact, it has ambassadors in one or two places where we do not have ambassadors. Addressing the Vatican diplomatic corps, Benedict said that attention has rightly been drawn to the danger of a clash of civilizations. Now, our own leaders in the United States and Britain have put down the idea of a clash of civilizations, describing it as a myth of history. And yet I'll show you this afternoon that this clash of civilizations between Islam and the Christian or Catholic West has been a constant theme of history. So Benedict said that attention has rightly been drawn to the danger of a clash of civilization. Its causes are many and complex, not least to do with political ideology combined with aberrant religious ideas, meaning Islam. The comment by the newspaper is, unlike many in the West, the Pope has not been afraid to point out the troubling incompatibilities of Islam and Western liberalism. You know, the church is, if you look at history, is always one step ahead. The politicians can only think about the next election. But the church as an institution has survived 2,000 years, and it has survived by always thinking ahead. So in 1978, for example, the electors chose John Paul II as Pope. Why? Because there were already rumblings in Eastern Europe that the whole communist system was in trouble. So by choosing a Pope from Poland, a man from Poland, to become Pope, you know, it brought the whole system crashing down. Communism just collapsed. It turned out, by the way, a couple of weeks ago, that the Russians were behind the attempt to assassinate the Pope in 1981, because they could see that their empire was threatened by the Pope. And eventually, of course, the Pope turned out to be more powerful than communists, than the communists in Moscow. And, you know, the church is one step ahead. The church has chosen now a German. Why a German? Well, Germany is the most powerful country in Europe. And here we now see an attempt to revive the Roman Empire. You know, Germany would have a dominant position in the new Europe. So, best person to have as a pope is a German. But they're already thinking beyond that. You see, what's going to happen? Because now the greatest threat to the church comes from Islam. So, you know, we've got to think about that. Anyway, we'll look at that a little bit more this afternoon.